This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you from Simon Fraser University's Burnaby campus in British Columbia.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, Israel kills kids from Gaza to Tehran. We speak with journalist and the executive producer of Al Jazeera's Fault Lines, Leila El-Aryan, about a new documentary on the human cost of Israel's attacks on Iran.
One day he says that yesterday we saw a cat on the car. He was like, do you see this cat? He doesn't have parents like me. I'm not having my parents anymore.
A lot of the Iranians that they spoke with also brought up Gaza. You know, they said this is repeating some of the same patterns we've seen in Gaza, and they also brought up kind of Western hypocrisy when it comes to human rights.
And on the resistance report with John Elmer, West Bank resistance confronts military raids.
This military operation raiding over 220 sites, up from the normal daily average of about 40 invasions a day raids into the West Bank. So it's a higher tempo, but there is no in-between raids. The West Bank is subjected to 24/7, 365 days a year of essentially policing operations that are executed by military units and death squads.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on December 11th, 2025. Later in the show, we speak with Leila El-Aryan, the executive producer for the Al Jazeera documentary series Fault Lines, about their latest episodes on Israel's killing of Iranian children and the case of Gaza's Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who remains arbitrarily detained since his abduction by Israeli forces last year on December 27th, 2024. On the Resistance Report, the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer covers confrontations against the IDF's Five Stones operation in the West Bank, with locally manufactured Carlo pistols, grenades, and IEDs as Israeli demolitions target refugee camps. But first, we've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Paying a High Price in Gaza by Khaled Al-Kershali, writing from Gaza. I wake up at 7 a.m. and immediately head outside to the street to check our water supplies, Khaled writes. In front of the warehouse where my family lives are our three buckets. Only half of one of them is filled with water, and I know I will need to replenish our supply. I wash my face and start to walk over to the school next door to see if a water shipment has come. Along the way, I see my neighbor Fayaz Shabbat, and he tells me that the water shipment did not come. During the week, only one water shipment came. I return to the warehouse where my father, mother, brother, and I have been displaced since February in Deir al-Balah in southern Gaza. My mother is awake, kneading dough. I ask her what she wants from the market, and she asks me in turn what I want to eat. We ate canned meat yesterday, I say, so it is better to eat something cheaper today. It has been a while since we last ate rice, so she asks me to try and find 1 kilo of rice. My grandmother is listening to us, so I ask her if she wants anything from the market for my grandfather. She asks me to bring tomatoes, if there are any, and to only bring 4 or 5, as 1 kilogram costs around $50. I put on my sewn slippers and head to the market. My grandfather Ahmad, who is 82, sits in his wheelchair in a shaded area of the street. I say good morning to him and continue walking. After 5 minutes of walking, I pass by a neighborhood that has been completely destroyed. I pass by the ruins of a building where a massacre was committed by the Israeli occupation against the Al-Hawajri family. On a wall near the massacre site is a message written in red. Jude is under the rubble, 31 October, 2023. God is sufficient for me, and he is the best disposer of affairs. Jude has since been pulled out from the rubble, though, as another message on the wall tells us this much. 20 meters from the massacre, I enter the spice shop, and I ask the seller for the spices and the rice. The shop is crowded. The shopkeeper creates and mixes his own spice mixtures, and they are popular. When he gives me what I ordered, I ask him to give me his phone number to transfer the money to his Bank of Palestine account. I pay $4. I go to a grocery store on the other side of the street. Adel Oda, the owner of the shop, accepted online payments during the famine. I greet Adel and look for onion, garlic, tomatoes, and green pepper, but I do not find any. When I ask Adel about it, he says that no vegetables have entered the strip yet. I exit the store and walk for 20 minutes until I reach Al-Bahasi Market. I go there because, at one time, I could find everything I needed in that market, but this time I cannot find all that I need. The place is crowded with people, most of them paying with their bank accounts as well. I pay $11 for a kilo of rice and $1 for ice cream. I exit the market and walk rapidly for half an hour in search of the vegetables. By 8:30 a.m., I have reached Al-Birka Crossroads, where I know a vegetable seller who will accept a bank payment. The man tells me that tomatoes are non-existent in the market and that the prices of onions and garlic have skyrocketed again. He also does not have green pepper. I have around $37 cash in my wallet. I go to a grocery store on the other side of the street and buy less than 200 grams of green pepper for $5, garlic for $5, and one small onion for $10. Then I return to the warehouse and give my mother what I've bought. Those are excerpts from Paying a High Price in Gaza by Khaled Al-Kershali, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. Still to come on Electronic Intifada Radio, Western media and politicians continue to minimize or ignore the ongoing genocide. We talk to one keen observer of these trends, journalist Leila Al-Aryan. But before we get to that, this week on The Resistance Report, the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer covers the confrontations in the West Bank, including the recent Israeli military operation in the northern refugee camps of Jenin, Tul Karem, and Nur Shams.
This week, we're going to take a look at the West Bank, where the Israeli military has been carrying out one of its largest military operations in the last year. Of course, we're now almost a year on from more than 30,000 Palestinians being evacuated, ethnically cleansed, displaced from the refugee camps in the north of the West Bank, particularly Jenin, Tal Karem, and Nur Shams, during what Israel called Operation Iron Wall. And of course, it's important to note that Iron Wall had the full participation of Palestinian Authority security forces. So the PA, obviously, longtime collaborator force, but now the PA involved in an operation that has led to the displacement from the refugee camps of the Palestinian population that the PA purports to represent, though, of course, their mandate has long expired and they have no legal authority. They're still willing to work with the Israelis on the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank. This military operation that Israel launched, they launched it on November 26th in the West Bank, raiding over 220 sites. That's up from the normal daily average of about 40 invasions a day raids into the West Bank. So it's a higher tempo, but there is no in-between raids. The West Bank is subjected to 24/7, 365 days a year of essentially policing operations that are executed by military units and death squads. And that is the main difference between the resistance in the West Bank and the resistance in Gaza. In Gaza, the warehousing, the ghettoization of Gaza allowed a modicum of sovereignty and autonomy inside Gaza. It allowed the resistance to build up its capabilities. It allowed them to root out collaborators. Over the course of the 20 years that the Qassam Brigades built effectively the national army that we have seen fight for the past 2 years, the West Bank doesn't have the ability to stockpile and to build up because they're constantly subjected to raids. of all ages. Children are arrested outside of their schools, all the way up to anyone seen to be participating in any kind of political activity. The Israeli military called the operation Five Stones, and they said in a statement, before ground forces entered, the Air Force struck sites to seal off the area. After airstrikes, security forces began searching dozens of structures and questioning suspects. And according to OCHA, the Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs that monitors this kind of activity, their office reported that since the 7th of October, 2023, to the beginning of this operation, Five Stones, that the Israeli security forces had killed over 1,030 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, among those 223 children. They also wounded more than 10,000 and detained 20,500 people in the last 2+ years in the West Bank. They can't move from one area to another because there's multiple permit schemes in the West Bank that prevent that. There's apartheid roads that split the territory up and make travel very difficult. All of these things are realities for the Palestinian civilian population, but they also have significant implications for the resistance. The ability to transport weaponry, to share weaponry among the different regional battalions is deeply restricted by this. And of course, there's also an 800-kilometer concrete wall, 8-meter-high concrete wall that runs around these territories. It doesn't separate, the wall does not separate so-called Israel from the West Bank. It separates Palestinian communities from other Palestinian communities. The wall wraps around Palestinian communities. It doesn't go along the border of 1948. The whole eastern edge of the West Bank, the whole Jordan Valley, is a complete military, closed military zone. So the entire eastern side is cut off, and then there's the wall on the western side, and the wall runs through it. We're looking at apartheid roads that only Israelis can travel on. And there's, of course, checkpoints, permanent checkpoints, flying checkpoints that show up at any given moment. There's partial checkpoints that are occasionally staffed. There's partial checkpoints with open gates, with locked gates. There's closed roads. There's observation towers, earth mounds, roadblocks, earthen walls, road barriers, trenches. All of these are used to separate Palestinian areas and to reinforce Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And this is what makes the discussion in the Western media about two-state solutions. That ship has sailed on this land. This land has already been carved up with the goal of preventing Palestinian contiguity, continuity of the communities, continuity of social life, as well as all other aspects of life. It's difficult to get to hospitals through these checkpoints. And all of this is the context in which the resistance is forced to operate, along with the 24/7, 365-day raids that happen in the dozens each and every single day. That being said, the West Bank resistance is still operating. The two principal IEDs that are used in the West Bank are the Tufan, the Flood, and that is the large explosive that is a ground-based penetration. We're watching them be detonated against army vehicles over the past 2 years. But they make a Sigil, which is a directed IED. The Tufan is the buried-in-the-road IED, much heavier. But they also make grenades and anti-personnel explosives. Unlike in Gaza, the Israelis never leave their tank. At this point in the West Bank, they're walking on foot, which makes hand grenades and self-propelled explosives meaningful. Sri al-Quds field commander spoke about this the other day, just after the launch of the operation. He said, for several weeks, the leaders of the Zionist enemy have been trying to create weak and pathetic field achievements in an attempt to break the fighting spirit of our resistance and the heroes of our people by assassinating the fighters of Sri al-Quds in the cities and towns in the occupied West Bank. We implemented appropriate plans suited to the field data and conditions after studying and analyzing the behavior of the enemy army and sensitive information which we obtained from drones that our fighters dealt with using appropriate firepower, shooting down a number of them in the Tubas Governorate and the Al-Fara refugee camp area in recent weeks. Our fighters in the Beit Umar Company in Al-Halil in Hebron, the heroes of the Nablus Brigade, were able to preempt expected Zionist action and surprise it with ambushes and explosive devices, which caused a shock among the enemy soldiers and officers, and the enemy admitted a number of them were injured. The moment the enemy announced the launch of the failed operation, which he called Five Stones, our fighters were laying in wait for them and in the first hours managed to disable a D-9 military bulldozer, targeting it with a Tufan ground explosive device, and disabling a military jeep by detonating a Sigil-type directed explosive device in the town of Tamun. The enemy thought he would break the will of the fighters by assassinating our brothers Yusuf Asasa and Al-Muntasir Abdullah in Jenin, but our Mujahideen rubbed their noses in the dust of the Jenin countryside and smashed their stones with explosive devices that were prepared and planted in advance on the routes where the enemy was expected to pass. We reassure our people, the Saraya al-Quds commander says, that our capabilities are fine and our fighters are highly prepared and vigilant, and we will not allow the enemy to create a new reality in the cities and towns of the West Bank. We renew our call to the Palestinian Authority security services to stop pursuing our fighters and immediately release those detained fighters that are tortured in your prisons, to allow them to carry out their sacred duty to defend our people and their property against a war of annihilation targeting Palestinian existence in all of Palestine. That's the statement from Saraya al-Quds commander in the West Bank. During the operation, dozens of field reports, more than 50 field reports, detailed operations in Jenin, Nablus, Tubas, and Halil, Hebron. In Jenin, in the Northwest Bank, there was 10 Sigil operations, 13 Tufan operations, 9 firefights, and 5 defensive ambushes targeting a Namur troop carrier, a D-9 armored bulldozer, as well as the West Bank only armored vehicle, the Panther, which they do not use in Gaza because it's not heavily armed enough to deal with the Shawad that the Palestinian fighters in Gaza have. In Tubas, 2 grenades and 2 firefights and downing of IDF quadcopters. In Nablus, 2 IEDs, 2 grenade operations and multiple anti-personnel ops, along with 2 firefights. And in Halil and Hebron, 5 grenades and explosive devices, as well as 5 firefights. 4 soldiers at least were wounded in those 50 operations. But like we know in Gaza, the Israelis obfuscate the casualty rate, so it's difficult to know if that's the true number. This is the Israeli military now showing their successes, what the Saraya commander called their pathetic achievements. They say in this statement, IDF troops from the commando brigade and regional brigades and the Israeli Air Force, together with Shabak and the Israeli border police, completed an operation to counter terrorism in the northern Samaria area over the past 2 weeks. During the operations, troops eliminated fighters, apprehended dozens of wanted suspects, and questioned many additional suspects. The troops also located and confiscated hundreds of thousands of shekels, dozens of weapons, including pistols and Carlo-type improvised weapons, ammunition, and knives. This is the IDF statement. In addition, more than 30 targeted airstrikes were conducted by the Israeli Air Force. And further, they also located inciting materials and Hamas-supporting books. So they're raiding the West Bank, stealing money, grabbing a few pipe bombs, and bragging about taking books off people's bookshelves in the West Bank. So these are very minimal accomplishments. But of course, you can see these fighters are fighting with what they can. They're manufacturing their own weaponry the same way as in the Gaza Strip. Another West Bank innovation called the Carlo. It's a homemade gun that is created by spare parts from other guns and metallurgy that's done in foundries to create these weapons. And these weapons are used throughout the West Bank, building their own guns to carry out the battle in the West Bank. So that's the Carlo, and Israel's bragging about finding one of those during this widespread operation. So dishonorable operations were not limited to these. Of course, the Israelis also went around and rearrested people released in the prisoner exchanges over the past year and a half. Mohammed Al-Arda was infamously arrested the other day in Jenin. He is one of the 6 fighters that escaped from Gilboa prison in the Freedom Tunnel escape, where a spoon was used to dig out into the tunnel system underneath the prison, and they made it out free and were free for many days. When Mohammed Al-Arda was released back to Jenin, the first thing he said when he got off the bus was, "To the people of Gaza, O people of Gaza, you are the most honorable and noble people. You are the crown on our heads and the head of this nation. If there is anything to be proud of in this history of these nations, it is the Gaza Strip, he proclaimed. The Israelis also arrested Mohammed Naji Sabha. He is an author and military science writer who spent many years in prison. He's wrote a book on guerrilla warfare. Again, so very dishonorable to be rearresting people that were released in a prisoner exchange and exchanged for Israeli soldiers and to then rearrest them. It just casts doubt on all of these deals. And that's not surprising, but it is dishonorable. Really, what the Israelis have been doing over the last year, this is a map from the Israeli military. This map came from the 877th Judea and Samaria Division. This is courtesy of Abdullah, who's filing a complaint for war crimes and crimes against humanity against the Israeli generals who are in charge of this operation. This map was handed out to people in Jenin. They were given 24 hours to leave the camp entirely with what they could carry on their backs. We reported on this at the time in January of last year. They left the camp so that the Israeli military could destroy the camp. And along with this map came this order from the Israeli military that says, by virtue of my powers as a military commander and my other powers under any law, and since I believe that the order is necessary for purely military purposes, I hereby order the following. I hereby order the demolition of the buildings. The process of demolishing the building shall begin within 24 hours from the time of the signing of this notice. That is what people got in Jenin and were forced out. And at the time, Major General Avi Bluth, who's the chief of the Central Command, which is the regional command for the West Bank, he said in April, quote, we are operating in the refugee camps and carrying out significant operations that change the character of the entire area. Smotrich followed up that by saying the perception of security must change. Tulkarm must be reduced to ruins. Buildings were targeted in the Jenin camp, hundreds. The reason why is to cut those corridors. And cutting these corridors has been a dream for the Israeli military, going back to the Second Intifada when their forces were defeated in the Jenin refugee camp in 2002 in the Battle of Jenin. They were killed in the alleys. More than 24 soldiers were killed, 13 in one day. That was the most Israeli soldiers that had died in a single day, going back to the 1982 Lebanon War, and they were killed in the alleys of Jenin, particularly one ambush in the area of Jenin that is called the bathtub, where soldiers were lured into the alleys and attacked from all directions, killing 13 in seconds. The response to it at the time was, of course, to demolish the Jenin refugee camp. And then for years, there was battles between Israel and the UN about trying to rebuild the Jenin camp to have these routes, to have routes through the camp that tanks can drive on so that soldiers can be driven right up in their armored troop carriers, open the door, and they can go right into a house. They don't have to walk on foot through the alleys of Jenin, through the alleys of decades of resistance from these alleys of Jenin that haunt the Israelis. And so they couldn't pull it off after 2002 to widen the roads in the Jenin camp. And before the genocide in Gaza, it was considered a red line to ethnically cleanse refugee camps, have people out of their homes indefinitely, and then to completely just redraw the routes through the camp. But of course, the genocide had no red lines, and Israel saw that. They adapted to the fact there was no red lines. You can see that happening all throughout the Gaza war as they escalated the wanton destruction and war crimes. So they saw that, and they saw, we have a chance to do something historic in the West Bank. This is the moment to strike. And they did. And they did it right after the ceasefire in Gaza. They moved in and evacuated people out of these camps. 32,000 people have been driven out of the camps. You can see the same thing happening in the Nur Shams camp, densely populated because there was no room for these refugee camps to grow as the Palestinian population grew from the late 1940s and early 1950s when these camps were established. And now you can see in Nur Shams there, those routes have been cut through Nur Shams. That allows the Israeli military to cut the camp into sections, and it allows their troops to move through the camp. So policing operations carried out by ethnic cleansing. They have bulldozed people's homes, family homes that have three generations living in them, refugee homes, and those people have been displaced again to make those roads. And where they'll come back to live with that many houses destroyed is unclear at this point. So under the fake achievements of a military operation, they're carrying out this ethnic cleansing and destruction of the refugee camps. Last week saw the field execution of two fighters in Jenin, Yusuf Ali Assasa and Al-Muntasir Abdullah. They were executed after they had fired their last bullets. They fought until their last bullets. There was a Reuters cameraman filming the battle. And then we saw on film the fighters come out. They're out of bullets. They have no weapons. They're unarmed. And the Israeli soldiers execute them in the streets, which was an obvious field execution. You know, the United Nations Human Rights Office called it a summary execution. It's appalling and consistent with everything we know about Israeli cowardice. Yusuf Ali Assasa addressing the fighters in Jenin. He's a commander of the Jenin Brigades. He says of the resistance and the Palestinian people that the path of liberation is long and costly, but we will be victorious. We will be freed from this occupation, and we tell them we will continue on this path no matter the cost. Our martyrs, the ones before us and the ones that came after, are the beacons of light that guide the path to liberation. We will continue on this path no matter the cost. So that's Yusuf Ali Assasa. He was field executed in Jenin and caught on camera. And of course, there will be no repercussions for Israel at the current moment. And that is the resistance report for day 797 of Israel's genocidal war.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. On June 13th, 2024, Israel and the United States launched a 12-day war on Iran. Al Jazeera's Fault Lines series executive producer Leila Al-Aryan joins me and the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunima to talk about their latest documentaries, Target Tehran, about the human cost of Israel's attacks on Iran, as well as The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safiya, about the pediatrician in northern Gaza abducted last year by the Israeli army. Leila, welcome back to Electronic Intifada Radio.
Thank you so much, Ali and Nora. It's an honor to be with you.
Leila, we're going to talk about Palestine in a bit, but first, the latest episode of Fault Lines was just released. It's called Target Tehran. In it, reporter Hind Hassan goes to Iran and meets the families of some of the people killed during Israel's 12-day assault on Iran this summer. Let's start with a couple of short clips. In the first, we see survivors of the massive attack on a large residential building in the Iranian capital, which was home to nuclear scientist Dr. Mehdi Tehranji. He was killed along with members of his family and members of many other families in the building.
Killed Dr. Tehranji was so powerful that it tore through multiple floors. This is one of them.
This is the third floor where Iraji Rasuli and his wife lived, and as you can see, it's also completely devastated. His daughter, her husband, and her two sons had been visiting and sleeping in the living room here the night that Israel attacked.
Iraj and his wife survived, but their daughter Zohra, her husband Behnam, and their baby Rayan were rushed to hospital with catastrophic burns. Within days, they were dead. Rayan, just 2 months old, was the war's youngest victim.
The 2-month-old boy couldn't tolerate the pain and injuries. Just passed away maybe in less than 24 hours. And both parents died in one day only, same day.
Their 4-year-old son, Kian, survived. He suffered third-degree burns over more than half his body.
Does Kian know what happened to his parents and his brother?
No, he doesn't know. But he has understood that they are not coming, so it seems that they are killed, and he doesn't know the meaning of the death. One day he says that, yesterday we saw a cat on the car. He was like, do you see this cat? He doesn't have parents like me. I'm not having my parents anymore. And I have to smile in front of him.